Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today's guest is Hikaru Nakamura, one of the two most popular chess players in the world. Hikaru is a five-time US champion, the reigning Fischer Random World Champion, and he is the current number two in the live ratings with a stunning 2800 plus rating. But most importantly, certainly in his own view, he is an immensely successful streamer. Chances that you follow his YouTube channel are considerable, as he has an awesome 2.4 million followers. I spoke to Hikaru in Norway, where he had just finished second in Norway chess, behind his big rival Magnus Carlsen. On the day of the closing ceremony, the players were invited to the villa of one of the sponsors in Sola, a seaside resort in Rogaland County, not far from Stavanger. While the other players and guests were playing chess or cards, I managed to lure Hikaru to an annex to the villa, which used to house animals but is now a comfortable guest house. There we sat down to talk about the subject I had suggested, none other than the future of chess. Hikaru, let's talk about the future of chess. I have the feeling that chess is at a crossroads, that people have to decide which formats will become dominant, if there should be mixes. You've been at a crossroads a couple of years ago and you decided to take a certain direction. How do you see the direct future of chess?
Yeah, so I think as we look at chess right now, there's the obvious split between online and over the board. That's the first obvious difference. And then if we go even further and we look at over the board, there are differences between, say, Fischer Random, classical chess, rapid, and or blitz. I think mostly the schism right now or the difference in viewpoints tends to relate to classical and rapid specifically. For myself, I actually really do like classical currently. I think my results sort of speak for themselves, where I've had really good results. I've really enjoyed it. But there are fewer and fewer classical tournaments in general versus the past. And even though I obviously primarily focus on content creation over playing professionally, even if I were to sort of switch the exact opposite, go the exact opposite way, we would be in a situation where I still could only see myself playing maybe six classical tournaments a year versus when I go back to 2018, 2019, when, if I'm just guessing, I probably played something in the range of 10 to 11 classical events per year. So even if I were to go back to playing professionally, it would be significantly less. And I think that sort of the reason for that is a lot of people are trying, let's just say, to monetize chess. They're trying certainly to go towards faster formats, hoping that there will be larger viewership, which on the one hand makes some sense if there are commercial sponsors. If we live in the world that we're currently in, where it's primarily around individual wealthy sponsors, individuals who have a lot of money, then I'm not so sure that that approach makes a lot of sense.
What are your preferences at the moment? I mean, you're streaming a lot, but why?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are all sorts of different ways to separate. I think, you know, for myself, if I'm looking at this from the long term and something that I think is viable, that comes down to commercial sponsors. Now, how do you obtain that? I'm not so sure the way is through rapid events, because a lot of people, I guess, on the outside don't really understand how the monetization process works. But effectively, to put it in simple terms, it comes down to online viewership. The viewership online is the only way that you can get commercial sponsors. And I think the numbers right now probably don't really support it, which would essentially say that the current formats are not working if that is the approach that you're trying to take. If we look from that standpoint, I think it's very, very, I'm very skeptical about that. I think that in terms of the individual, the wealthy sponsors who are putting up lots of money, some of the billionaires like Rex Singfeld, for example, or I guess Vadim Rosenstein in Germany, or Jan-Henrik Büttner also in Germany. And I think that model still is going to exist. But that's really the bridge, is between the individuals and trying to commercialize it. And what is the path forward? I mean, as I said, right now, when I look at the online viewership, I don't really know if it supports commercial sponsors. And so that's really the sort of the question, is whether you can unlock that potential or not. And on the other side with the individuals, I think right now that model is pretty stable. So it's sort of a question of whether you can have separate models which can be successful. But I would add that, I mean, when you look at it from the general standpoint, as a chess player hoping there's more money in chess, the commercial approach is the only one which could exponentially increase the prize and the amount of money that professional players get versus the one with the wealthy individuals who are privately sponsoring events.
Yeah, you mean if you really want to see a significant rise there, because these individuals that are sponsoring, they remind me very much of the Messinuses that we've always seen in chess. Mm-hmm. It's not that you feel that they're building a sustainable system that is self-supporting.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've spent my life in chess, and when I see the wealthy individuals who have come and gone, it seems like as soon as one goes, you try to find someone to replace them. That's not really, I would say, something that's viable. In general, it's not something that's sustainable in the long term. Whereas with commercial sponsors, if you can build up chess and bring in, you know, let's just say a Google, for example, it's much different than a wealthy individual. And that is a company that could just continue to support chess for 10, 15, 20 years down the road if there is an economic model that makes sense. So that's why I think the upside is much higher from trying to commercialize chess. But whether we get there is, of course, the big question.
Yeah. Well, you started streaming. When did you get the feeling that you were onto something that you thought, well, this is going to work for me. This is going to make me more money than what I usually do by playing over the board?
I think at the start, it was just something that I approached as a form of entertainment, something that I actually greatly enjoyed. I just did it because I enjoyed it more than anything in 2019. I would say that when the pandemic hit in March of 2020, that's the first time that I thought maybe it could be a little bit more. But really, it was only, I would say, around June of 2020 when there were suddenly these very massive sponsorship opportunities that existed in a way they never had before. Actually, I would say never exist, period, throughout my entire chess playing career.
Can you say something more about that for people who don't have any idea how that world works?
Yeah, so what I would say is that so when the pandemic hit in March of 2020, I started streaming every day. And at that time, there were no major sporting events or anything. So a lot of the advertising budgets and companies, they were looking to the online content as a way to promote their brands. And how it works more specifically is there would be companies that would approach various streamers based on the viewership size, and they would offer you, say, X amount of money for either a stream of a couple of hours, maybe a couple of posts on Twitter or Instagram along those lines. But in many cases, those sponsorships would be better than, I would say, the middle of a, finishing in the middle of a Grand Chess Tour event.
Yeah. And how do they make their money? Is that purely advertising?
That's not necessarily my, I'm not going to know the answer to that question, because obviously I'm not in advertising. I mean, yeah. I think the way it's viewed is if you reach a certain amount of eyeballs and people see your products, that gives great brand awareness, and potentially people will buy the products down the line. Yeah. I don't know. Of course, I don't know exactly how that works, but that's generally, I believe, the approach that these companies take, that if you have X amount of viewers who see something, maybe some amount will buy your products, and or they'll just be aware of what the brand is.
Yeah. Well, you are very popular, and I think that what you're doing is absolutely great. I mean, I'm not someone who watches a lot of streamers, but I can watch you. And the thing I'm always wondering about is how do you keep the enthusiasm? Because it's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, so I think the way that I'm able to find the motivation to do it day after day is primarily from the fans, from the viewers. I think that it depends what you internalize or the messages that you read. But I think for me, at the end of the day, when I think of my viewers as a collective, I'm trying to think of them as people who are watching my stream. And why are they watching it? I think in many cases, when people are online watching streamers or watching content on YouTube or Instagram, wherever it might be, there's something that's missing in their life. And so when you're spending that amount of time on social media, there's probably something in your life that's not going great. And so for myself, I generally try to think that I'm trying to give them something that they can enjoy, something positive throughout that day or throughout the weeks or months they watch me in general. And that's what actually helps me keep going, because it's very, very difficult when you see all the negativity on social media in general. You know, even for myself, there are a lot of people who say terrible things about me every single day. And so that can bring you down. But on the other hand, you have to remember that there are a lot of people who are very loud, but they are at the end of the day the vocal minority versus the silent silent majority, I guess you could say. So it's generally the fans and thinking that I'm bringing something good to them every single day. And I think that's what, for me, I really, I really find a great joy in that.
And is that because it's also more than just chess that you want to be, well, you show yourself as a person?
Yeah, I think, it's funny, I did another podcast earlier today, and, you know, one thing that I said is that for me, I've been very fortunate, the life that I've lived in general. I've been able to travel a lot from a very young age. And a lot of people, when you grow up with that, you sort of start to think of like, what is your normal? And that becomes what you think is normal for everybody. But in reality, it's quite far from the truth. So I think when I talk about these stories or talk about my life, it's a very interesting life. And even if to me it seems very boring, a lot of people have not been able to travel that much. I mean, you look at Americans, I think something like half the people who live in the United States don't even have a passport. And here I am where I was already traveling from the age of 10 years old. So that does make a huge difference. And I think my ability to convey these stories in a way that's relatable plays a huge part in terms of people turning out to watch my stream. So I'm not sure where I was going with that, but at any rate, I think that's a large part of why people watch me.
And is that also the reason why you find it easy to stream when you're on site, when you're playing a tournament, that those spots, this effect is even stronger because you're there with the chess players that they also would like to meet?
You know, I think that there are a couple things. So first thing is, I mean, not to sound really mundane or boring, but like what I'm streaming these days is also part of contracts that I have. So just you kind of have certain obligations you have to fulfill. But what I would say is that one of the big things that changed, and I remember this in 2020, this was very early on, this was May of 2020. I played in it's called the Magnus Carlsen Invitational. And I remember that tournament, I made some joke. What was the joke? I'm trying to remember. It was something like, if I make it to the final or if I win, I'm going to like drink a bunch of beer. Actually, out of this glass trophy I got from the Singfield Cup, I think in 2017. So I have this big trophy sitting on my shelf in Florida. And I didn't win the tournament, but I still filled it up with like six beers or something. I started drinking on stream. Yeah. But the point what I was trying to make with that is that what it showed me was that regardless of whether I won the event or whether I didn't win the event, there were going to be fans who were going to cheer for me no matter what. And that is a very big thing because in chess, which is something that's so individual, when you actually compete, if you don't win the tournament, you generally actually feel very bad about yourself. You feel like you failed. And then to have those fans who are supporting me, it makes you realize that, you know, they're going to support you pretty much no matter what. And that changes sort of the whole approach and the psychology to it all. And then if we fast forward to like now when I stream during some of these events, mostly it's the fans and just like trying to be there, be present, and hopefully they can give me some positive encouragement.
Yeah, they are your fans in good and bad days, and they just want to see you and hear you what you are experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's true. I think that's a big difference between the chess world. When you look at the chess world as a whole, I don't feel like it's a world where people are generally very positive or supportive. I think in general, in many cases, people are hoping to see you do poorly. I mean, I can sort of speak for myself, or even Magnus. I feel like whenever Magnus loses a game, everybody's ready to say, okay, he's done, he should quit, he's terrible, he's not as good as he was 5 years ago. All these different things, but with the whole online sphere and people who do watch the true fans, they are going to support you no matter what. And I think that's not even applicable necessarily just to chess, but across the board when people are competing, they are going to support you. And you actually see that with some of the other chess streamers too, where they're not at the same level I am, but people are still cheering for them regardless of whether they win or lose. And I think that sort of speaks volumes about the big difference between the online community of people who are watching streamers and chess specifically versus like the chess only, the hardcore chess fans.
Yeah. Well, you used to be a chess player who didn't take losses easily. Now you don't lose that much these days, but it happens. Have you found ways to deal with that, or is it simply less important because you have to stream anyway after a loss?
So I think, well, I mean, are we talking, you mean stream or recaps? Which one?
This is the recap. Recap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's easy to get a little bit of clarification the recap. There. But
sorry.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I look at it, ultimately, one of the reasons I do better is simply I don't feel that pressure. I think my value or who I am as a person is no longer tied solely to the results that I have in chess tournaments. When I was a bit younger, and I think this is more when I was a professional player, it very clearly was that they were one and the same. You know, if you lose a game or you don't win a tournament, the direct impact is felt in the rankings and or invitations to potential tournaments in the future. So everything kind kind of was tied together, whereas now that simply isn't the case. And I think the fact that it's not tied together has given me a big sense of freedom to where I'm able to simply play chess and try to play my best and not have to worry about these sorts of things. So it's very, very different. And I think it shows in my chess that if you don't have the pressures, the burdens, the fears, and the worries, you can actually play much better, even if I'm getting a little bit older.
Yes, but that's probably only part of the truth. I mean, when I had a preview of the candidates with Anish Giri, and I said at some point, well, you know, with Hikaru, it's he doesn't feel this pressure these days. I mean, he doesn't need to do it for the money. Then Anish said, yes, but Bill Gates doesn't have any money problems. You saw what happened in his game against Magnus. So it's only part of the explanation.
I mean, you could maybe say that, but I think ultimately every human is different. And the experience you've had throughout your life, they play a huge role in how you view things. And I think for myself, I mean, it's very easy actually to contrast Anish and myself, or even I would say, I'll take a better example, someone like Jan Ludvig Hammer from Norway. I won't use Magnus because he's obviously a little bit different. Yeah. But if you look at someone like Anish or you look at Jan Ludvig Hammer, these are players who... I don't really want to be political here, but these are people who grew up in a system where they're taken care of by their governments. If you look at someone like Anish, he's never going to have to worry about healthcare or things of this nature. And same goes for Jan Ludvig Hammer, actually. He's a better example because he's a little bit lower rated. They don't have these same worries. They have certain safety nets. You know, if you look at Norway, you have the sovereign fund. You have people being supported by their government. I'm not going to say like it's out of this world great or anything of that nature, but they are supported. And with myself growing up in the United States, pretty much from the time that I was 18, 19 years old, none of this stuff existed. There's no safety net. There's no retirement plan. There's no healthcare. There's no healthcare. You have to pay for it. So because of all these different things, my perspective is one of I'm trying to maximize as much as I can up until I quit chess at 40. Like if I look at myself from the time I was probably 20 till about 30, the goal was to maximize as much as I could until I was 40 years old because I did not want to play chess beyond that age. Yep. And when that's a driving factor behind what you're doing, you're going to be approaching whatever field it is, and chess in this case, you're going to be approaching it differently where it's very, very results oriented and you're trying to stay at a certain level until you get to the age of 40. So when Anish says that, like for him, his perspective is very different than mine because of course he doesn't have a lot of these concerns, you know, even for Anish, I mean, has, I think, three kids now. He's a great family. And I'm not going to speak so much about systems. I'm not a politician, obviously, but I suspect that there is some state support. I suppose it's not as much of an issue with like the healthcare system in the Netherlands, the way that, you know, if I by chance happen to have three kids, if I do, I think that's going to be much more of a serious concern for me than it is for Anish. So like, again, all the perspective and all these things kind of wrap themselves together and everyone's view is different. So like when I say this from my standpoint, it definitely is true that, like, you know, worrying about the future, worrying about being secure, it probably was the biggest driving factor in my life up to a point. And so then as far as the candidates goes, you know, I think that's one of the things that helps me a lot is a lot of people have their own perspective. And so Anish has his perspective, which is completely wrong about me. And like, I understand why he thinks that way, of course,
it was a joke. Yeah.
Maybe, but even if it's not a joke, like I completely get it because his perspective is completely different from mine. He didn't grow up in the U.S. So like that's the thing is when you know, say the money doesn't matter, like, but when that's the thing that sort of you derive, when that's the thing that's in the back of your mind, every tournament you play, every game you play, the world rankings, this, that, and the other thing, it plays a huge role. And I would also say even going back further, if you go back to 2014 or 15 when Fabiano had the huge result? Which year was it?
Was it 15?
I don't know if it's 14 or 15, but you know, Fabiano had this huge result in the Singfield Cup. He starts off like 7-0 or something, or was it 8? 7 or 8-0, whatever it was.
Out of 7.
Yeah, he has this massive start. And he's obviously going to be switching federations back to the U.S. And you know, I remember that time, it felt like the world is ending. Like, because I was also having a very bad tournament. I had this horrible game, I think, against Magnus, where I was lost after, like, move 10 in one of these Slavs. And so it felt like the world was ending at that time. And that's one of those things where those sorts of concerns, all these worries about, like, where you are in the world rankings, all these different things, like, they play a huge role. And you generally, it's very hard to overcome those sorts of things. And that is the big difference, that now when I compete, I obviously want to be competitive. I want to do well, but it's not something where, you know, if something goes wrong, everything is, you know, the world is ending. It's all a disaster.
Yeah. But you must feel very comfortable because you say, I'm going to quit when I'm 40. And I believe you. I remember another American who was going to quit when he was 40, Gatakamski. And I thought, I'm not so sure that's going to happen, and it never happened.
Yeah, you know, and I think, like, actually, to for anybody who's wondering, also, you know, a large part of my views or the formation of, like, why I look at it this way is because, like, when I look at someone like God, and he's not the only example, you know, you see people say these things, and then they get stuck in chess. And I mean, I don't want to be critical about chess as a whole, because obviously, like, we're very fortunate. We get to travel the world. We do get to make a better living than a lot of people. But when I look at someone like God, or actually someone like Yasser Seirawan, for example, I'm under the impression these are people who wanted to play chess. They had this life plan, and then they end up having to stay in chess beyond when they wanted to. And so whether it's people like that, or whether it's the American Grandmaster, you know, the people like Joel Benjamin, Larry Christensen, you know, I could go on and on, the people who were very good when I was just starting out. I see a lot of those guys, and I feel like they don't enjoy chess. They don't like it. They're having to teach or do courses, all these different things. And they're doing it because they have to do it versus wanting to actually do it because they love it. And so that also forms, plays a huge role in terms of the formation of how I view it, in terms of why I say when I'm 40, I want to be able to quit. Like, I have this image of, like, being 60 years old. I mean, now I don't have it, but when I was younger, you know, I had this image of being like 50 or 60 years old, and I'm having to show up to some chess tournament, do commentary. I'm having to do these things that I absolutely hate, but I have to, because I have to make a living. So, and now it doesn't exist anymore.
And does that, in fact, give extra enjoyment now? Because, you know, okay, I'm going to do this for two more years, and
First of all, I'm not sure if I will quit at 40, to be fair, because obviously I'm in a situation where I have options. But what I would say is that, yes, I definitely find much more joy in all of this than I would if it were purely a job. If I were playing chess simply because it's a job, then I have the feeling that I would not enjoy it. And that's actually the biggest difference between now and even going back to 2019, is that when I do play chess, I just enjoy it. I enjoy pretty much every moment of it. Whereas in 2019, I sit down to the board. I mean, I'm trying to think when was the last time I had a Berlin, because it's been a while. But it's like it's like one of those things where you sit down to the board and you know, I think I'll use Isle of Man as an example. Like, you know, when I played Fabiano, I think it was in the 10th round, second to last round, whichever round it was. And I played him, and he played one of these, we've gotten to one of these four-night scotches. And I can tell you that in 2019, if I got to that situation, I'd be like, oh, great, it's this very boring four nights. It's going to be a draw. We're going to go home very early. How boring, how unexciting the game was. But now when I play these games, it's like, I know it's most likely going to be a draw, but I actually enjoy it. Like, I'm enjoying every moment of it versus just being like, okay, whatever, who cares? It's a draw. That's life. Big deal. And I think being positive plays a huge role, because when you're very negative about things, I would say more often than not, bad things find a way of happening.
Yeah. Well, when we briefly return to these recaps, where sometimes you have to overcome disappointment, do you find support in the fact that there's a certain structure in it? I mean, you have this recognizable introduction when you sit down, and can you do it?
Yeah, what, in today's video?
Yeah. I push the button and there it goes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wish it were that simple, but...
No, but please, for the few who don't know this.
You want to hear the current one that I'm doing, yeah. Welcome back, everyone. For today's video, we're here with Dirk-Jan Huizendam. I'm probably mispronouncing your last name, but I'll try to do it. We're here doing a recap of Norway chess.
Great.
but actually, you know, I think the thing, you know, probably the hardest thing about doing the recaps is not the recaps themselves. It's the fact that I'm not someone who's an editor. I don't edit my own videos. I don't possess these skills. Yeah. And so because I don't possess these skills, I do have a team around me that do these things. So when I do the recaps, I actually do them in one take.
Yeah.
And that's probably the hardest thing, is to do like a 15, 20 minute video without like losing your train of thought, without like having some coughing fit, all sorts of different things that can pop into your head. That makes it very difficult. But back to your point about doing it after losses, what I would say is that ultimately I've done it enough now that it doesn't really bother me. If I do a video after a loss, I mean, I think probably for the people who, you know, there's a very big difference between people who were in chess before the pandemic versus in the post-pandemic world. And I think that many of the people who were in the chess world prior to the pandemic, and this can also come back to my performance as well, but a lot of people simply can't really fathom that it's possible for me to have completely changed, both as a chess player, but also as a person. I think many people just can't, they can't wrap their head around it because they think it's impossible. So like for me, when I do these recaps, the thing is I've gotten so used to doing them over and over the years now that I just do it. It becomes like second nature versus like the actual impact of a win versus a loss. And I think the moment that I feel a lot of people actually started to realize this was when I lost to Fabiano in the first round of the candidates in 2022, I believe it was. And I still did a recap the same as always. I mean, I think a lot of people, it's just the assumption that, you know, I'll give you a better example. When I was really young, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, just starting chess, you know, of course I had chess base and, you know, at that time it's stupid because compared to now, but like you go, you take the score sheet, you enter your games and everything. I remember when I was like 8 or 9 years old, I would go enter the games for the wins and the loss. You just throw the score sheet out. You don't put the game in your database and that's that. Yeah. So you just have a bunch of wins in your database. I think a lot of people sort of view it the same way where it's like, okay, you're doing a recap because you won, but what happens when you lose? Because of course you're not always going to win every game. But it's just one of those things that's become very second nature to me. And honestly, I think when, you know, even if I can be disappointed in a game, it's not something that changes a whole lot about who I am as a person. So it's not really that big of a deal. And I think even the game I lost against Ding, you know, I was definitely disappointed when I lost that last round game, but the disappointment was maybe for an hour and then it was just gone. And you know, that also comes with something where once you get into a routine of doing live streaming, like I would say that within my mind, the mindset is always, okay, you finish the stream, okay, you have the next stream, you have the content. It's always a process of moving forward to the next thing. So I think that also helps a lot with chess, where even if I lose a game, it's on to the next day. It's very easy to actually forget about it in a way that it wasn't before. Even like Gukesh, I could be unhappy about that game, but the next day or two, I was already streaming. So it's very much on to the next thing immediately without dwelling on anything.
Well, and I get the feeling that you also like the show element. I mean, it's like Prague is never Prague. He's Prague Nananda. Ha ha ha.
Well, that's not my joke. That's Chris's joke.
Oh, really?
I'm okay with that. I just stole it from him. But I mean, I think also it's just, you know, the fans, they really do enjoy hearing the insight. And of course, for me, as someone who's played chess my whole life, I mean, honestly, I can't wrap my head around it. It's just something where, to me, it seems insane. Like, why would anybody want to watch my recap or Levy's recap or anything like that? Because, of course, there's nothing special to it in my mind, or I mean, I think in his mind even. Yeah. But still, for a lot of the fans, they do actually enjoy hearing those thoughts. And so it's something that I think does provide benefit for those people. And of course, you know, for me, it also helps keep people interested in whatever I'm up to.
Yeah,
which tournament play.
One of the things I often wondered about is that when you're speaking about the Italian game, which is the Gioco Piano, and you call it persistently the Gucci Piano, that's on purpose?
That's on purpose.
That's okay. Well, where did that come from?
It's funny. That came, I think that's a combination of a few things. There, I think early in the pandemic, there was some meme about it's, I think there's a saying, it's all Gucci. Meaning everything is good. This is the first meme. But then there's also the other meme related to Ali Reza Farrugia, because I think he's wearing Gucci or something. Yeah. He's into fashion. You know, they call him Gucci Reza. So I think it's a combination of both of those things. I think initially, though, if I think back to the actual origins of it, I suspect it started during the initial podcast when I think one of the streamers called it the Gucci Piano, I think.
Yeah.
But it's tied in. I think it's primarily tied into the saying it's all Gucci.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful history of an expression.
Yeah.
So,
but actually, you know, it's funny because like it's clear that not everyone realizes that I'm joking. Because I remember when I played the FIDE Grand Prix in Berlin. I don't remember if it was the first leg or the third leg, but one of the arbiters of the fair play guys, this Grandmaster Alex Kolovich, and I think I did a recap and I showed it the next day, and he asked me, I was like, you do realize how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah.
He didn't realize I was actually making a joke out of it. And like when you hear a GM say that, it's like, okay, wait a second. Like then you know, you start to think, well, maybe I'm actually doing a really good job if someone actually thinks that I don't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah. Are there other misunderstandings that you've created? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the obvious one is the fianchetto, of course, when you develop the bishop. And that's also based off an internet joke because there's a streamer XQC and he said fianchetto. So yeah, so basically that's also another obvious one that I do on purpose. Most of the like the big mispronunciations are obviously done on purpose, and I do know how to pronounce them. But, but at the end of the day, yeah, usually that's done because of something that happened during the pandemic that I've just incorporated into sort of into the show, you could say.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT introduced digital clocks to the chess world at a time when only analog clocks were used. For over 30 years, DGT has been making the official FIDE chess clock, endorsed by the World Chess Federation. DGT clocks are the world's best-selling chess clocks, the standard in chess timing and used everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Well, we're going to talk about the future of chess. We've had a huge peak in chess for the past years. How long will that last, do you think?
So it depends how we look at this. I mean, I think how we look at it and who benefits from it. So I think from the standpoint of people coming into chess, I think you're going to keep having new beginners, you know, going to sites like chess.com for a long time to come. I think that's going to remain extremely strong. It's hard for me to see that falling off. What I would say, however, is that the people who are now signing up for sites like chess.com, I think they're going to chess.com to start with, versus during the pandemic where it felt more like people were going to YouTube and or Twitch and then integrating over to chess.com. So the path of people getting into chess, I would say, is quite different now than it was before. So as far as like live streaming goes in general, I mean, I think it remains reasonably strong. I mean, you have to remember, and this is what I always say to myself about the topic, is that like chess is in a much better place than it was in 2019. This is a very important distinction, because whether you're looking at chess or and maybe not in chess, but you know, one of the biggest things that people make the mistake of doing, or one of the hardest things to deal with when you're an online content creator, is like the clicks, the likes, or the viewership. I mean, if you have 500,000 people clicking a like button on one post, and then you have 50 on another one, it's very hard to deal with that. Same thing goes for the live viewership. You know, if you have like 10,000 and you have 5,000, it can be very difficult to deal with as well. So what I would say about this, I mean, definitely the live stream numbers are down versus where they were before. I do think there are going to continue to be various spikes within chess, but I would say that I'm kind of skeptical that all the live stream content, everything along those lines, will remain strong for, you know, beyond the next like 2 or 3 years, if I'm just being completely honest. So we'll see where that's going. I think that, you know, for example, YouTube will remain extremely strong with the edited long form content. So I think that part is doing very well. And then from the player's perspective, I think the top level tournaments are doing completely fine at the moment. There seem to be more wealthy individuals who are sponsoring tournaments, but it still doesn't feel like we're heading towards a commercial route, which actually seemed extremely likely, I would say, if you go back to like 2020 and 2021. So there are pluses and minuses across the board. I mean, I think like, you know, YouTube will remain strong. Chess.com, I think, is going to continue to do very well. I think that the tournaments which are sponsored by these wealthy individuals are going to remain as long as they're here. But the commercial side of it, I'm actually struggling to see the future.
Yeah. Well, you say it's all about clicks. Mm-hmm. How addicted do you get to watching the number of clicks? And are there were there moments when you really got a kick out of the clicks?
Well, I mean, I would say for me, it's not so much clicks. It's more about the actual viewership on the live streams versus YouTube videos. Yeah. You know, I think what makes it very difficult, and this isn't just about chess, but for live streaming in general, is that if you do hit it big, there's going to be a period of time where your numbers are just going up, up, up every single day. And at some point that has to stop. Like, it can't keep happening. And when I look back to 2020, it was nonstop. Like, it felt like every day from March till about July or August was endless. Like, just some new milestone every day, whether it's more viewers, whether it's more subscribers. I mean, it just seemed like the list went on and on. So at that time, I was definitely enjoying it. But I think the biggest thing that I've been able to do is to sort of ignore it. And like, even when the viewership has come down, it's just keep going about things. with realizing that it's still much better than it was in the past. So probably 2020 for a period about like March till about like May or June, when all the numbers were just going through the roof, that's probably the only time that I really paid super close attention to it. I mean, I'll still get a kick out of it when I see some of the numbers today, but it's not something that, that will like really create any kind of emotion in me.
Yeah. But what kind of average viewership do you expect? I mean, when you...
So it's hard to know, but I mean, I think the simplest way of putting it is one of the big issues currently with the whole chess ecosystem is that there really are only two names that can draw a big audience. Those names, of course, I mean, there's my name and there's Magnus Carlsen's name. And the other problem I would say is that if we're not playing each other, that already is a big problem too. I mean, it seems to be the only matchup that really can drive engagement online. You know, when I think back to when I played him in 2020, and this is probably like overall, when I look at the whole, everything that happened during the pandemic, easily my favorite moment. But when I played him in the Champions Chess Tour final in September, I think it was August or September of 2020, I think on my channel, like, I mean, that's when I reached my peak viewership of somewhere around 85,000 concurrent viewers on one of the days. I think in general, I was probably like 30 or 40,000 every single day throughout that 7-day event. And chess.com was probably similar as well. So when you're talking about like 100,000 concurrent viewers, that is an extremely high number. And I would say that those numbers are very likely not going to be attained again outside of perhaps a Canada's tournament or the World Championship match. Those are the only two events specifically that I think can get such a viewership unless there's a match featuring Magnus and myself that we're playing. So I would say that I'm a little bit concerned about it. I think that I view it as something where even the Champions Chess Tour has struggled lately. I think the format's become a little bit stale, a little bit old. And maybe they can get 20,000 concurrents, but I would also say that, you know, the bar is much higher now than it was back in 2020. You have these sort of numbers like 20,000, you could get sponsorships very easily. Nowadays, I would say probably you need something closer to 100 to get a big sponsorship. So it's not wonderful, but still, as I always say, it's better than it was. And I mean, I think at the end of the day, if I've been a part of that and chess in a better place now than it was back then, that is definitely a good thing.
Yeah, but still the system... well, relies on these two names, which makes it vulnerable. How can the rivalry, or let's say the simple presence of the two of you, be secured for the coming years?
That I don't know. I mean, it's very tricky because I would say Magnus and I mean, obviously we're different. I mean, he's a 5-time world champion and I'm not. But I do think that we're sort of in the same boat. We're at stages of our career where we pick and choose the tournaments we play, and we're two of the very fortunate players that we have that ability. We're not beholden to the system. We can pick and choose where we play. And Magnus plays some tournaments that he wants to play. I play some tournaments I want to play. I'm not really sure how you can ensure that, but I think that you know, whether it's, you know, I personally would say something along the lines of a Chess Champions Tour or a Grand Chess Tour done a little bit differently is probably the best chance of getting us to ensure our participation going forward. I mean, I don't have anything specific in mind, I would say, but something along those lines.
Yeah. And how are your personal relations? Are there any personal relations with him or...
No, I mean, Magnus and I don't really talk to each other. What I would say is in general, I think, you know, there's a lot of, we're much more laid back now. So, you know, for example, if I see him, I'll shake his hand, I'll say hi to him. I mean, I know he spoke to my stepfather the other day. And I think a large part of that is more because it's kind of like we realize where we're at in our careers. I mean, I don't want to say we're at the end of our careers, but you know, if you look at how long we've been playing chess in both of our cases, I mean, I think it's, I don't think it's insane to think that within the next 5 years, one, if not both of us, could be retired from chess. And so because the end is so much closer than the beginning, I think a lot of the friction, a lot of the competitive drive kind of it fades away because you realize the end is much closer than the beginning. And ultimately, I mean, not just Magnus, but you look at most of the top players. And the fact is, I mean, these are the guys I've been spending my life around. I mean, the last decade plus, like these are the people that I've spent more time around than anybody else.
Yeah. Well, part of the future of chess will depend on new formats, new ideas, developments. Here at Norway Chess, well, there's the shortened classical game plus the Armageddon. To what extent do you see that as a success?
I don't really see it as a success in general. And the reason I don't see it as a, well, I mean, maybe it is a success. I guess when you look at the term, the way that I view it is that if the tournament is decided by the classical games, it's been a success. So from that metric, it is, because Magnus won the tournament and there was no drama. Now, of course, if I had beaten Olirez and lost two Armageddon games, we had some playoff even, could have been different. But I think as long as it's decided by classical, it's really hard to say the format doesn't work. And I think the actual score is close to 50-50 in the Armageddon, other than Magnus, who wins every game with white. So I don't necessarily think that it's that big a deal, but I personally don't really like the Armageddon. I think that there are too many situations where you have these games. And I mean, for myself, I feel like it's hard for me to actually be motivated when you've played like a 3-4 hour, very tense classical game. And then you just show up and play this game where they're really, in a way, I mean, you could say there's something on the line with the half point, but in reality, I mean, there's no rating. It just doesn't have the same feel as a normal game. So I would say that, I mean, I don't like the Armageddon, but as long as it's side by classical, I guess you could say it's successful still, I guess.
Mm. Well, and probably many fans, they would suspect you of liking the Armageddon because of your Blitz reputation.
I guess you could say that, but I mean, I think in these days, I actually like classical chess much more, I would say, than, I mean, it depends. To be fair, I haven't played over the board Blitz in a long time now, but I definitely prefer classical to rapid. I would say that without a doubt. So, I mean, I still do enjoy the quicker formats, but I also feel like in an Armageddon where you have to win with white, or you have to avoid losing with black. I mean, the decisions you make are definitely a little bit different, I guess you could say, in that situation. And also, I just don't like playing without increment at this point in my career.
No, but the, let's say, the fact that you like the classical game at the moment, that is because it's a change of diet, which occasionally is welcome.
I think the reason I like classical more is because I actually just like thinking more than anything. I really like the ability to think for 20 or 30 minutes on a given move. I think that's something that, as I've gotten older, I just do it much more frequently than I ever used to. So I think that's the main reason that I like it more. But I would say that, yeah, it's definitely online. All I do is play Blitz and Bullets. So the ability to kind of think, certainly when you're spending like 5-6 days a week just not thinking and just playing on intuition, it is a nice change. So yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because I think that must be one of the tough sides of the streaming. I mean, doing that and keeping the enthusiasm for.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really mind that, but I would also say, as part of my shift too, away from like the online rapid events, like I don't enjoy playing the online rapid events. I'm not even sure if I'm going to play any more of the chess.com ones going forward. But that's the thing, is that like I either like it very slow or I like it very fast. One or the other, like the in between for me, I find it very hard to play these days. Yeah. It's very, very, very difficult.
Yeah. Another part of the future of chess is the new talents. There's a new generation that looks very promising. What is your view of that? What are your expectations of them and what they will bring to the industry of chess?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at a lot of what Magnus, et cetera, the other top players of his generation, my generation, I would say the players who are in their early to mid-30s, many of us have made, complained that, classical chess is dying, this, that, and the other thing. And I think that that's actually just wrong. And I think that when you look at chess, and I've started to incorporate this into my game somewhat, is that one of the realities is that with computer programs and how strong they've become, that effectively any opening is playable at the top level even. Any opening is playable as long as you know what you're doing. Computers know that everything is equal or close enough to equal. And I feel like a lot of players in the 30s, and especially in the period, I would say 2017 to 2019, became very boring. Everybody started playing these Berlins, these Italians, these very boring openings over and over and over again and making a lot of draws. And I think that with the new generation, they're actually more open to experimenting. You look at the players like Prague, you look at players like Arjun. I mean, Noderbeck is another example. And these guys are very, very aggressive with both colors. They try to win games. And I think as long as that becomes a style of play, classical chess going forward is going to remain in good hands. I think the older generation, the Nepos, the Fabis of the world, I mean, more Nepo, I would say, Nepo and Wesley specifically, they're definitely the players who are who complain a lot more about the game being boring. I mean, they have a lot of draws. And, I think that's more they've become very set in their ways and they don't experiment as much as they once did.
Yeah, I mean, they are, you say, they are largely to be blamed for that themselves. They should be more adventurous.
Absolutely. But again, it's very easy to say that. But also, the thing is, it's not easy to change. Like, and, that's also why I would say when people talk about Fischer-Random, for example. You know, a lot of top players, you have people like Levant saying, you know, how great it is, or Mag saying how great it is. And I mean, I'm not going to lie. I obviously enjoy being able to show up and play a game of chess without any preparation. But you could also make the argument that it's just the players are getting frustrated because of how hard it is to prepare and win games now. But, you know, chess moves on. If the young kids don't have a problem with that, you know, and they are the future, then I don't see any actual issue at all.
But you mean that the enthusiasm for Fischer-Random is partly...
I think the enthusiasm comes from a top player simply not wanting to prepare. I think they're tired of having to prepare and trying to get minimal advantages. I mean, I think a large part of why Magnus withdrew from the cycle is he would have had to spend months preparing, and most likely he still would have had a bunch of draws and not gotten anything out of his opening preparation. So... I think that's the driving factor, is that the preparation is so difficult, or they find it so difficult that's why they'd rather have these forums where you don't have to think as much. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I like it too, but I feel like the kids don't have this issue at all. I mean, for them, it's not a problem. They enjoy the challenge, actually. Yeah. So when I look at the death of classical chess, is very overblown when it comes, because I look at the kids now. I mean, you look at the Prags, the Arjuns, the Noderbecks of the world. I think they're playing very enterprising chess, and so if they're able to keep playing these exciting openings, and they are the future of chess, and I think that we're definitely in a direction where classical is going to remain very excited. The biggest issue is always when you have these games that are drawn. You look at the Grand Chess Tour. I remember 2019. I played in the Singfold Cup, and I think the draw rate was extremely high. I want to say maybe it was like 70% or 75%. It was extremely high. There were very few decisive games. I think actually the tie for first place was on +1. So in general, if the kids are playing this very enterprising chess, I do think that classical chess is nowhere near dead, even if the older generation is struggling a little bit. And so I don't see that really fading anytime soon. I mean, I do think Fischer-Random has potential, but Fischer-Random, I think, ties more into whether you can get commercial sponsorship for those events. And if you can, then I think it has a bright future. But I would say for me, it's not really that big of a deal whether those events happen or don't happen.
No. And I feel that it's easy to like Fischer-Random as a player. I mean, I also like it. But to sell it as a product and to get it across to the fans is not so easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big issue with Fischer-Random specifically is that at the end of the day, it doesn't have the history behind it. I think if someone takes up chess tomorrow, there's so many things that they can get fascinated and enthralled by. For example, the names of the openings, the history of openings like the Ruy Lopez or the Italian. You have openings that are 500 years old. The history within chess is so great that there are a lot of these different things that add to the fascination with the game. And when you look at Fischer-Random, you don't have this, but also the basic patterns don't really exist in the same way either. I mean, maybe you could say that you're supposed to play for the center, but the bishops develop differently, knights develop differently. And for someone who's not a quite advanced player, I don't think it's easy to follow whatsoever. And ultimately, the biggest audience in chess is going to be the beginner base. They are the largest market. And if they can't follow it, then I'm really skeptical about selling it to the masses.
Yes. Well, several of the strongest players or the strongest talents now, they are from India. What do you expect India to contribute to the development of chess?
I think the future of chess right now, as I look at it, I mean, I think the three countries that have great potential, I think there's India, I think there is Uzbekistan, I think maybe Iran as well. Those are probably the only countries, maybe Turkey, I forgot about Turkey as well. But those are the only countries where I see multiple kids who are very, very good at a very young age with like super talent potential. So, I look at the future as almost certainly running through India, just because you have three great players. I think I really don't think you can say any one of them is better than the other ones. I mean, I don't think you can say Gukesh is better than Prag or better than Arjun for that matter. I mean, they all have their strengths. So future of chess definitely runs through India. Now, I would say one of the things that makes the future quite interesting is that these players from India are also, in a way, I think, not beholden to the system, because they have state support, they have private sponsors who are funding them. So they're not kind of beholden to FIDE in the way that, you know, a lot of other players are. So because of that, I think there is more potential for exploration, and potentially things could change. On the other hand, you could also argue maybe it cuts the other way, where the players have no incentive to push for change because they're getting all the support privately. But I do think that, you know, the future of chess runs through India. What that looks like, very hard to judge, but I'd probably give you great odds that we'll have an Indian world champion within the next 5 years.
You have a preference or?
I don't have a preference. I mean, if I look at it and I look at the players, I mean, for me personally, as someone who didn't really have all this great support and had to really fight my way through the ranks, I would probably say that, you know, if I'm looking at any one of the Indian kids, it probably would be Arjun, because my general sense is that I feel like he got a big sponsorship recently, but I feel like a lot of the attention has been on players like Gukesh and Prag more specifically. So I'm always going to probably root for the one who I feel like is a little bit more underrepresented.
And what about his play? What is special in his play that appeals to you?
I think when I look at the play, Arjun's play is much more raw. He's much more aggressive. When I look at Gukesh or Prag, I feel like they have much more. They're much more sound. It feels much more fundamental. Whereas I feel like Arjun just plays crazy chess all the time and tries to win with white and black. Mm. So his chess, I don't. It doesn't feel like it's steeped in, like, you know, fundamental training from, say, like a Russian coach, for example. Whereas I feel like both Prag and Gukesh, it's much more systematic and it's a lot less free flowing.
Yeah. Well, you said that you intend to quit when you're 40, but there's no firm promise, or maybe we can retain some hope. What are your plans? Do you have plans that you see yourself follow after you're 40?
I mean, I would say I really haven't thought about my career beyond playing chess and beyond streaming at the present time. But that being said, you know, somewhere around 40 is where I see myself kind of dipping a little bit from this. And I think even now when I look at it, you know, I would say as far as live streaming goes, I still do enjoy it immensely, but it's one of those things where, you know, there's like a gas tank, and at the start it's completely full and it's slowly going lower and lower. And I mean, I still enjoy it, but I, even now, like when I was playing the games here, this isn't about live streams, it's more about the recaps. But even when I was playing the games and doing the recaps, I felt far more tired from the recaps than I ever have in the past. And I don't really see it as something where it feels like it's only going to keep going in that direction. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see when the end comes. But regardless, I mean, at least for the next couple of years, I think I'm pretty set on what I'm doing.
Yeah. Your life is very intense. It's a kind of life that I can imagine you become addicted to. Where do you get your...
Well, I don't know if it's about being addicted. I mean, I think what I would say is that for me, I've had a pretty clear-cut plan in my life of what I want to do or where I want to be at certain ages. And I think when you have a plan, it becomes a lot easier to kind of like visualize it and then actually make it happen. And so like that's the thing, is I think a lot of people who like get into live streaming, for example. Now, mind you, I've been very fortunate. I had the career and everything. You know, I was already in my 30s by the time everything took off with live streaming. But I would say a lot of people don't have a set plan in mind. So for me, with the set plan in mind, that, you know, thinking about getting to the end or getting to some point makes it a lot easier to deal with on a day-to-day basis.
And there is enough on the side that you can focus your attention on then?
Well, I mean, we'll see what I choose to do in life. Yeah. I mean, there are many different paths of things that I could do. But, you know, also contrary to what a lot of people believe, I mean, the idea of being able to simply just go and be nobody, be anonymous and just live life away out of the public spotlight is also, there's a lot of allure to that as well. So I don't really know what the future holds, but there are definitely multiple paths.
And normally speaking, chess will be a part in that new life too.
I don't know. It's hard to judge whether chess will always be a part of my life. You know, it's difficult because on the one hand, you know, think about all the people that you can reach through chess, all the people that I have reached with a big audience. But at the same time, you know, within the chess community as a whole, there are a lot of people I feel like have been very disingenuous and have been very nasty to me over the years. And I don't necessarily want to deal with those people either. So it kind of cuts both ways. And I don't really know whether it will or won't be part of my life. Mm. But, you know, we'll see what the future holds.
Does that mean that for a long time you've seen yourself as an outsider and still do?
I mean, nowadays it's a little bit different, certainly. I mean, I would argue one of the biggest reasons that it's different now is that I think a lot of people actually start to realize that, like, you know, the people who can actually drive the interest in chess, whether it's the Magnus of the world, whether it's, you know, me, people like that, is that we're not going to actually be around forever. And I think as people start to realize it, some of the attitudes start to change a little bit. So it just depends. But I would say now I feel a lot less like an outsider than I did when I was younger. But there are definitely times that I still do feel it.
Yeah. Wonderful, Hikaru. Thank you. Thank you very much.
No problem.
It was a pleasure to speak to you and to listen to you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.